Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Now the biggest mindset change going forward is, yeah, they can have him. So how do we mitigate that?
Southeast communities confront a future where deadly landslides might be the new normal. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a new facility opens in Anchorage to house homeless elders.
Being in the shelter system, that is not a normal life. I mean, you have to be on your guard all the time that somebody's not stealing your belongings. Here, you don't have to worry about that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Four fatal landslides have struck communities across southeast Alaska since 2015, killing a dozen people. Landslides are nothing new in this region of steep mountainsides and heavy rain, but the idea that every few years another southeast Alaska community has to dig its way out after a fatal disaster, that is new. As Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, the string of recent deadly slides is changing the way people look at their surroundings and plan for the future as they reckon with their own risk in a changing climate.
Ketchikan gets more rain than just about anywhere else in Alaska. It's the kind of rain you have to empty out of your coat pockets before you come inside. Mountainsides across the channel on Gravina Island are streaked with scars from landslides in the years past. But even so, landslides never felt like a threat, says Ketchikan Mayor and local historian Dave Kiefer.
If you ask most people here, they're going to say, well, if it was going to happen, it would have happened by now. So that's where the shock comes that all of a sudden, boom, this happens. And it really feels like it comes out of the blue.
The Third Avenue landslide that rocked Ketchikan last month was unprecedented. There had been some scattered rock slides and smaller landslides, often in areas where humans had disturbed the ground in some way, but never before had a 250-foot wide section of hillside just up and given way. It crashed downhill nearly a quarter mile in just 15 short seconds. It killed a city maintenance technician who had come in on his day off to clear storm drains. It just hadn't happened in the 130-odd years since people started living on the banks of Ketchikan Creek year-round, and certainly not right in the city center. So yeah, Kiefer says this was a change.
Now the biggest mindset change going forward is, yeah, they can happen here. So how do we mitigate that?
That is a big question and not one with easy answers. Communities across the region are looking to mitigate the risk, but their options are limited. Forecasting landslides is difficult. Home insurance doesn't cover landslide damage. And some efforts to address landslide risk on a community-wide basis have run into pushback from residents. It's a question on the mind of another Southeast Alaska mayor, too, Tom Morfitt in Haines. In 2020, after an atmospheric river dumped heavy rain for days on top of a thick layer of snow, a landslide on Beach Road killed two people. Looking at photos of the Ketchikan slide, he says, is unsettling.
There really was nothing in the area of the slide that you can say, oh, we cut too many trees there or we cleared too much there. It was just, and that's, I guess, maybe the spookiest part of it of all is that, you know, a bunch of 300-year-old trees and vegetation can just move on you and just collapse.
And he says living with that risk, knowing the hillside could one day simply collapse, makes it hard for communities to plan for the future.
It's a whole new regimen of things we have to figure out because of these weather extremes.
It's a question that Sitka reckoned with in 2015 after a series of slides, including one in town that killed three people. That led the then director of the Sitka Sound Science Center to convene a team of researchers to address the problem, says Ron Heitz, the center's senior researcher.
I think for a lot of people in the community, it really sort of made them aware, much more aware of the fact that these things can occur and they can occur right in town.
Heitz says it's hard to say whether landslides are becoming more frequent in Southeast Alaska. It's an active area of research. But Heitz says 90%+ of them are associated with so-called atmospheric rivers, which bring moist tropical air northward to the region.
And we're getting more atmospheric rivers as the climate warms, and the atmospheric rivers seem to be getting more intense.
So how can communities respond? Well, Heitz says, for one thing, it's important to create maps of what areas might be the most risky. Those can help guide policymakers as they consider new areas for home and business development. But Heitz says that knowledge is both a blessing and a curse for homeowners.
On the other hand, they're sort of reluctant to know that they don't really want the municipality to know or the insurance companies to know because they're afraid of what it would do to their property values or their insurance rates.
And efforts to translate those risk maps into policy have indeed been controversial. City leaders in Sitka ultimately rolled back restrictions on development imposed after the 2015 slide. In Juneau, the Assembly declined to adopt new landslide hazard maps after hearing pushback from homeowners who would have been placed in high-risk areas. Regardless, Hines says it's difficult to get insurance covering landslides in Alaska. Researchers with the RAND Corporation, a policy think tank working with the Sitka Sound Science Center, found it just isn't something the market would provide on its own. So it would require some sort of government intervention. Maybe something akin to the National Flood Insurance Program.
If you live in a flood zone, the federal government requires you to have flood insurance, and you pay into a pool for flood insurance. And that would be the way landslide insurance would have to work.
One effort that's less controversial is a warning system that lets people know when conditions are ripe for a landslide. There's now something like that in Sitka. It's a website that provides a 72-hour outlook for landslide risk based on recent rainfall data. And Kiefer, the Ketchikan mayor, says better weather data closer to town could help people in Ketchikan better prepare for landslides and look out for warning signs like dirty runoff and saturated soil. For now, Kiefer says Ketchikan is reckoning with what it looks like might be the new normal. He says the slide is changing the way he looks at the landscape.
Every time I drive on the 3rd Avenue bypass, probably for the foreseeable future, I'll be thinking about, you know, that's the hillside that came down. Could it come down again? It suddenly adds a bit of uncertainty into our lives that wasn't there before.
But Kiefer says there's one thing about the recent slide that does give him hope, and the reassurance that if and when disaster strikes, Southeast Alaskans will come together to help their community bounce back. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Eric Stone.
Providence, Alaska and South Central Foundation opened a new supportive housing complex in Anchorage for elders. It will house single people or couples over 55 years old who are experiencing or at risk of homelessness. And as Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports, it will help house some of the rapidly growing number of elders experiencing homelessness in the city.
Steve Austin is showing off his new apartment at Kutunkunka. That means elder's house in the Dena'ina language.
This is the living quarters. It's my living room, dining room, and my bedroom. Got a beautiful queen-size bed to sleep on.
The building is also known as Providence House. It's a new supportive housing project in Anchorage that combines housing, case management, and healthcare.
This is the kitchen area. I do quite a bit of my own cooking.
What do you like to cook?
I cook steak, eggs. One of my favorite things is to make a big pot of chili.
Austin says the last time he had stable, independent housing was about 5 years ago. He says living here will help him get back on his feet and get his life together.
Being in the shelter system, that is not a normal life. I mean, you have to be on your guard all the time that somebody's not stealing your belongings. And here you don't have to worry about that because everything is in your room. You're there by yourself. You don't have to share anything with anybody else.
Austin is one of the first residents to move in to Kutunkunka. 16 people live there already, and ultimately it'll house about 45. Experts hope it's a small but important step towards helping solve the complex homelessness problem in Anchorage. The city has the largest population of people experiencing homelessness in the state and not enough shelter space to support them. Almost 20% of people in emergency shelters are over 55. Michelle Baker heads South Central Foundation's Behavioral Services Division. She says it's a constant challenge to find people supportive housing in the state.
What we have today doesn't meet the needs of the thousands of individuals that live unsheltered. And so we are super grateful for the providers that have permanent supportive housing, but we certainly need a lot more.
Baker says after the city closed the temporary shelter in the Sullivan Arena last summer, it was hard to keep people in new housing without helping them with other health and behavioral health needs. So she says organizations, including Providence and South Central Foundation, started talking about collaborating to help people with more holistic care. South Central Foundation will have an office suite on the first floor of Kutunkunka, where they'll offer case management, medical care, and behavioral health care. Baker says it's one of the first programs in Anchorage that will offer housing alongside therapy and behavioral health care. Tim Zarichny heads Providence's supportive housing projects. He says housing can be seen as a first step in providing good health care.
Someone who's experiencing homelessness, someone who has chronic health conditions, someone who struggles with mental health, they come in and our first intervention is housing. Our first intervention is stability.
He says providing permanent supportive housing like this project also reduces costs in the healthcare system overall. He says research shows that even after a year of supportive housing, people are much better off, and they rely less on emergency care services, which are expensive. Heather Skelton Fry is a clinician working in Providence House. She works in intensive case management for South Central Foundation. Although their office space isn't yet finished, Skelton Fry is already working with residents.
It's been really exciting watching people come from not knowing where they're going to sleep or where they're going to live, and then they get handed this beautiful new space to live in. And it's providing a sense of hope.
She says it's always a challenge to find stable housing for her clients, so this collaboration will allow patients to work on other needs. And she says the public often has misconceptions about who needs help with housing. The cost of living in Anchorage is high, and she says many elders rely on Social Security or other benefits that often aren't generous enough to cover market rate rent with living costs. New Providence House resident Steve Austin is one of those people. And as he figures out his basic needs, he says he has more plans. He wants to create a small space in his studio so he can make art. And he hopes to date again.
Oh, I'd like to kind of get myself back into a relationship with somebody and maybe even get married. I don't know. I've never been married before. And I'm 65 years old. It's time if I'm going to, I should probably do that.
Austin says dating while staying in shelters is hard because they have strict curfews. But living in Katankunka, he can stay out as late as he wants. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, students attend Yupik Immersion Charter School classes at a new building in Bethel.
I'm so excited for the children today. You know, it's just so nice to have our own building.
That's ahead. Stay with us. The North American Aerospace Defense Command tracked and intercepted two Russian military aircraft Wednesday in international airspace near Alaska. A NORAD news release said the Russian aircraft remained in the Alaska Air Defense Identification Zone and did not enter American or Canadian sovereign airspace. Air Defense ID zones begin where sovereign airspace ends. International aircraft travel through the zones but must identify themselves. Russian aircraft have frequently flown through the Alaska Air Defense Zone, and they're usually accompanied by U.S. fighter jets out of Eielson Air Force Base or Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. The NORAD news release says the Russian sorties are not seen as a threat. The release did not identify the type of aircraft in the formation nor the type of U.S. fighter jets that intercepted them and escorted them through the Air Defense ID zone. The last time Russian aircraft passed through the zone was in late July, but the two Russian Tu-95 Bear bombers in that formation were accompanied by two Chinese H-6 Xi'an bombers. It was the first time Russian and Chinese aircraft jointly flew through the Alaska zone. A number of devastating cyber attacks across Alaska have prompted many public entities to redouble their digital security measures, and Petersburg Medical Center is among them. The hospital is revisiting its cybersecurity practices in response to two hacks over the last year. As KFSK's Shelby Herbert reports, it all started at an October 2023 hospital board meeting in the middle of a resident's speech.
Good evening, everybody. I'm born and raised here in Petersburg, and I belong to...
Petersburg resident Glow Wolin is addressing the hospital board at the podium with her toddler at her side. She's here to speak up for the continuation of the hospital's in-house child care program. She's nearing the emotional crescendo of her speech, a story about her late mother who worked at the hospital.
Lois happily passed away at the long-term care.
Then she's cut off.
So it goes without saying that...
Hang on, we got hacked here. Hang on.
Oh, geez.
Hospital staff have lost control of the meeting's Zoom feed, where anyone from the public can join in remotely. An anonymous guest fills the chat with racial slurs, and then they show a video of a man exposing himself.
Oh, my.
Just to end it, please.
The image is projected onto a large screen right next to Wolin for everybody in the room to see, including several children. Almost a year has passed since that meeting, but Wolin says what she saw that day is seared into her brain.
I think I was speaking eloquently about my mother, and yeah, and then I realized what was going on, and it was laughable because it was, you know, it was kind of so bizarre, and I'm not easily offended, so I just was really puzzled by the whole thing. And then it comes out that, you know, the ramifications for this kind of thing are pretty severe.
Jill Dormer is the hospital's chief information officer. She says the incident went all the way up to the FBI.
So because there were small children in the room, we actually opened a police report, went to the FBI, and the FBI was pretty transparent that they would research it, but it was very low possibility of finding who actually did it.
That wasn't the last time the hospital would tangle with hackers. This spring, one of their printers was attacked, making it churn out page after page of political propaganda. Dormer says that's when they knew it was time to look over their policies. Petersburg's hospital board is far from the only public entity in Alaska to be targeted by hackers in the last few years. This spring, the Delta Junction City Council experienced a similar Zoom bombing event when internet trolls disrupted their meeting with a pornographic video. Digital bad actors have hit other public entities across Alaska even harder. Several municipalities in Southeast were scammed out of close to $1 million over the last few years. And 6 years ago, a cyber attack kicked the Mat-Su Borough completely offline. Borough employees had to break out pens, paper, and typewriters until they could scrub all the ransomware from their servers. Dormer says her nightmare scenario for Petersburg's hospital looks something like that.
And ransomware actually shuts your whole system down. And so they go to a complete paper-based system, which puts them back, you know, 20 years. And they see a decline in services. They're not able actually to take care of as many patients at once. And a lot of their systems, both clinically and financially, fall apart. I would hate to see that happen.
Mark Brennig is Alaska's coordinator for the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. He says hackers are targeting Alaska with alarming frequency.
Because it used to be, well, why would anybody attack Alaska, right? You know, what's Alaska? You know, what are they going to go after, our moose and, you know, salmon or something like that? But that has all changed, right? Because now there's a lot more sophisticated tools that adversaries have. An internet connection now is an internet connection. It doesn't matter where you are.
He also says that as internet access has expanded throughout Alaska through things like Starlink, so has vulnerability to cyber attacks. And he says the state's rural communities contain particularly juicy targets.
It's target rich but resource poor. I get it. You know, I talk with people all the time out in rural communities where if they have an IT shop, and in many cases they don't, it's one person. And so they do not have the staff to do it. They don't have the money to buy the systems. They may not even have the training or anything. And so they feel completely hamstrung and don't know what to do, how to do it.
But he has some advice for Alaskans who want to protect themselves from hackers. There are the basics, like educating employees on safe online conduct and setting up virtual private networks, or VPNs, for teleworkers. VPNs basically create a private connection between the user's computer and a remote server, masking their data so nobody else can see it. Brennig says there are also a number of governmental and nonprofit groups, like the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CyberSecure Alaska, and InfraGuard, that help rural communities identify threats and counter them. But as to what those countermeasures are, he can't say too much. That's because he doesn't want to show his hand. In case the hackers are listening. In Petersburg, I'm Shelby Herbert.
An unspecified number of University of Alaska staff, mostly graduate students, went unpaid last week because of paperwork issues that the administration did not detail. The Alaska Beacon reports 85 of the University of Alaska faculty members affected by the paperwork problem were paid on time last Friday. The university said all remaining staff would be paid by early this week. UA President Pat Pitney apologized for the problem last week in an all-staff email and gave staff details about how the university would work towards a solution. In a Monday email, university spokesperson Jonathan Taylor said the paperwork issue was resolved. Students at Bethel's Yupik Language Immersion School attended classes in their own building for the first time ever on Wednesday. As KYUK's Sage Smiley reports, the new building represents decades of local dedication and advocacy for Indigenous education.
For 8 years, the students of Ayakun Litnaovik attended classes, yorakt, and butchered moose in a building that used to be a grocery store and still houses Bethel's two-screen cinema.
I teared up watching them kids opening their lockers. Oh.
Ayakun Lottie Jones is the school's namesake. She stands in the hallway of the new Ayakun Litnaovik, leaning on her walker.
The happiness they had, I just couldn't get over. How each child found their names.
Note cards with Yupik names are taped to the gray lockers that line the walls. Jones is originally from Skamon Bay and taught in Bethel for more than 40 years. She retired in 2022, but stays involved with the school that's named after her.
It's been, almost 29 years since, Ayakun Litnaovik opened. And for the first time, the students have a locker room. They have a gym, they have their own classroom, and all this is unbelievable.
Ayakun Litnaovik is a landmark of Indigenous education. It follows a Yupik subsistence calendar, teaching Yurtun, the Yupik language, and traditional knowledge in the classroom, out on the tundra, and up and down the river. It's been nationally recognized for its approach to learning and has been studied and modeled throughout the United States. The school began as a pilot language immersion program in 1995, after more than 20 years of community calls for Yupik education. It expanded one grade at a time, housed in various schools in Bethel, and officially received charter school status 4 years later.
I get to see it in the children. Their step is different this morning. I watched them from right here.
Anna Charlie has been Ayakun's school secretary since 1999. She sits behind the desk in a bright, brand new front office.
So excited for the children today. It's just so nice to have our own building. It's something that we've been looking forward to for a long time.
A catastrophic fire in late 2015 destroyed the Kilbuck school building that Ayakun Litnaovik shared at the time with another alternative education program. In addition to destroying the building, the fire incinerated decades worth of hand-developed Yurtun teaching materials, but the school pressed on with donations from around the state. A legal settlement between the Lower Kuskokwim School District and its insurance companies helped fund the new Ayakun Litnaovik. In 2020, the district broke ground on the building, but soon faced delays from the COVID-19 pandemic. Even while housed in the converted grocery store, Ayakun Litnaovik kept growing and added 7th and 8th grade in 2022 and 2023. Looking at the floor plan, the new immersion school is built like a fish, with classrooms arranged in a diamond shape around a central kazagik, or meeting area, with a gym attached to the tail. Teacher Agnachak Madeline Reichard welcomes students at the door near the fish's tail.
Buckles, can I walk you in, please? I'm so happy you're here. Let's go.
Reichard says teachers got access to the building just under a week ago. Like the rest of the staff, she says it's exciting and really special to finally, for the first time, have a standalone building for the Yupik Immersion School.
I think it's so important and so exciting for people to remember that we have kids that are now in eighth grade that have never been in a school that has had classrooms with walls and doors. And so this, as an eighth grader, 14-year-old, this is your first day in an official quote-unquote school. I've had so many kids walk in and tell me they were so excited last night they couldn't sleep. They've been up since 5.
Wearing an orange outer space print gusbuck, Principal Joshua Gill says it's thanks to Ayakun Lottie Jones's dream and vision that the school became a reality.
It's great having kids under the roof, so it's awesome. We're excited. We're excited for the kids.
Students and teachers gather in the brand new gymnasium. A rock wall lines one end, and straps hang ready to hold a wrestling mat that Principal Gill says is in the mail. A long curtain will serve as a backdrop for archery once those supplies arrive as well. Yuyanguk Rose Dominic sits at the edge of the bleachers. She says she tries to bring subsistence foods for Ayakun teachers' lunch at least once a month to show her gratitude and appreciation for the care they show the children.
There's
a lot more education that they provide. It's not just education to fill their minds, but it's education that fills the spirit, the heart. So those are equally important components of a human being that need to be nurtured.
With the students gathered, Ayaprun Lottie Jones stands facing the bleachers and leads the students in the school's song. The first time of many, it'll be sung in the school building that's finally home to the Yupik Immersion School after decades of making do. In Bethel, I'm Sage Smiley.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone and Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Shelby Herbert in Petersburg, and Sage Smiley in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.